You started in 61 at the hospital,
yeah.
Is that right? So did you see a number of different superintendents during the time you were there?
Yeah, Summerness was the one there. He was there for a long time. A couple of them were pretty useless.
Now, what part of the hospital did you work in?
It was in the nursing part. I worked on the wards, and I started out on the TB ward. They had where the pavilions is at now. There was a four-story building there. That was building 41, and it was for mentally ill people with tuberculosis. They did surgery every other week and stuff like that.
So were they all in quarantine or?
Well, yeah, it was. We wore masks and gowns. And then I went to Hall 20, which is chronic schizophrenia. I got along pretty good with aggressive patients. And they would always call me over to Hall 5, which is the women's district ward. One of the stories most people like to hear is we had this girl that she was locked up and couldn't get out because she was so aggressive. And she talked the doctor into letting her go to dinner if she had an escort. And so they'd call me up and I'd go over and we'd take her out of the seclusion room and I'd walk with her. She was just in a gown, so we'd give her a robe to put on and we'd walk her over to the dining room. And she'd say, "Mr. Maddox, if I can sit down with the girls, I'll behave myself. I won't do anything." I said, "Okay." So she'd take her tray and go through the line and get her stuff and go sit down and talk to the girls and eat. And then when she got up, I made sure that she put her spoon back because that's what, you know, they'd steal those spoons if they could because they'd sharpen them up for a knife. But then we'd go back to the ward and she'd walk around and look out each window. And they give medication at that time. And she'd be the last one up to the office to get her medication. And then I'd escort her back to her seclusion room. And she'd turn to me and she'd say, "Maddox, you son of a bitch, if you wasn't there, I'd have broke every one of those windows." He told me that every time I walked her to dinner.
Did you have to confiscate any weapons from any of those people that had made, say, a sharp spoon? Or?
Oh yeah, we'd find them. The girls were mostly the ones that would cut themselves, and that's what they used it for. Most of the guys would grab a pen or a pencil and go after you if they wanted it. I worked at Hall 6, and that was it. Disturbed ward, and they had like 10 seclusion rooms. There's a couple of them that never got out of the seclusion room because they just couldn't function out even with there. And then they had a run room set off to the side where they sat in there and staff supervised them all the time. But the other wards were all, they were free to move around. Most of the time, when I first went there, they'd just sat in a chair and leaned against the wall or stuff like that. We did play euchre quite a bit. There's quite a few patients that could play euchre and we'd play that. But when they started the medication, then the patients got a little bit more active. And I worked Hall 10 at that time, and that was all chronic schizophrenics. And we had a clown face that we had beanbag for. And we used to try to get them to play beanbag But once the medication got going, then they'd like to challenge us, and they'd get a big kick out of beating an attendant at that beanbag. So.
Did you work with that Dr. Ferguson at all? Or was he...
I just knew who he was, and he was around. He was a useless piece of meat. When he wouldn't move or anything like that, and Ferguson went in, we had to take a chair into the seclusion room and for him to sit in, and he'd sit and talk to the patient, and he said he needed an IV, and he told us what the IV was. So I went and got it, brought it in, and he said, "You give it to him." And I'd never given IV medication before. He said, "I'll teach you." He guided me into getting it into the vein and giving it all that. But I used to see him wandering around the grounds quite often. He had been treated for mental illness, he came up to do lobotomies, but lobotomies, I had never seen any that worked. Most of them just ended up with a big dent in their forehead,
And did you see a change in the behavior of the people that had
happened? They didn't know nothing. One of our officials, he was an accountant. He had a lobotomy, and he was up there. He was one of the patients on the ward. I can't remember what his name is now, but he just had a big, it was about that deep hole. The medication made the biggest.
That made the biggest difference.
Yeah.
What kind of differences did you see in the patients they introduced that medication?
Oh, we got this patient in, his name Guy Polino. And he was a teenager, and he had been into drugs and stuff like that. And he just sat perch on the window ledge in the receiving. They had wide ledges. He would perch up there like a bird. And we started medication on him. After about 6 weeks or so, he got... So he didn't do that quite so often. And I don't know, he'd been there for 2-3 months, and one night about 10 o'clock we were sitting on the ping pong table in a day room, him and I, talking and shooting the breeze and stuff like that. And he turned to me and he says, "Maddox," he says, "I'm gonna go to bed." He says, "You're crazier than I am." Medication did make a lot of difference. We had another incident. We had a South American doctor. We got a teenager in, and he gave him ground excess in school right away, and he'd be gone. But when he was on the ward, he was just nasty as heck to the staff, belligerent. Stuff like that, and that the meeting when they had a change of shift, they had a meeting, and I mentioned at the meeting, I said, "I think that we should take and medicate that patient," and we had a social worker, and after the meeting, she went down and told the doctor that I disagreed with the treatment of the patient, and the doctor come up to the ward and says, "I hear you I understand you disagree with the patient, my patient's stopping." I said, "No, I don't disagree. I said, I just think that when you have a meeting like that, people should be able to express, their thoughts, and so that you'll have the information." He says, "All right, we'll staff him next Monday." On Monday, they had staffing. And that would be all the medical staff and social workers and psychologists and like that would meet down in the room, and they'd bring in a patient and interview him. Monday afternoon when I come to work, Dr. Padilla come on the ward and said, come on down to the medicine room. I went down to the medicine room. He said, well, we staffed him today. He says, when we got done talking to him, I went around and asked everybody what they thought we should do. And I says, what'd they say? And he says, snow his ass with Thorazine. So they took his ground access away and put him on Thorazine. So, and he did improve, you know. He just needed it. Thorazine, Stelazine, those were the drugs that they used, you know, mostly. Those are the first two. Thorazine seemed to work pretty good.
And so he was the one that was belligerent to the staff. And,
yeah.
And what kind of things was he doing that made him hard to handle?
Just usual teenage, you know, go to hell. And, you know, wouldn't, when we'd call him for dinner, he would lag out and not, you know, didn't want to, would change the channel when, you know, on the TV when people were watching it. Just general, you know, stuff like that. Yeah.
Was he one that was dangerous? Did he ever sharpen a spoon or?
No, not him. He was one 6-year-old come in. It was a state police officer's son. He had attacked his brother and had beat him pretty bad.
He was 6 years old.
Yeah. Yeah, they had. When I first started, they had two wards, Hall 12 for those up to 16, and then 18 from 16 to 18. I got a sheet of paper I better give you in the car, in my briefcase. It's in 1960, you know, how much it cost per day to feed the patients and all that. Expense account, you know. That'll give you a good one.
And then, you know, obviously the price of things went up, but so did the cost of keeping a patient go way up after that? Or?
Well, yeah, it was, I think, 49 cents. But that's back when they had the farm. All the mail workers, see, the hospital divided down the center. Even wards were women wards and odd numbers. Even wards were male and odd numbers were female.
I see.
And that was the old center. That's where building 50 is now. That they talk about. This was the administration building, and that was dividing. You can go on the internet for Kirkbride architecture. It was, because see, back in the 60s, alcoholism was a mental illness. I worked all 20, and there was probably 10 or 15 there that, you know, were just diagnosed as alcohol. And I went to alcohol meetings every Friday. They had them. I was one that went there. And we had a business person from Traverse City that was there as a patient, and his was just alcoholism. Well, they had community mental health a long time before the hospital closed down. That was a regular part of the that they started up here. At one time there was 500 patients living in the Kingsley area in the homes out there. No, it was a bad thing when they closed the hospital, because a lot of the patients committed a crime to get locked up. Muskegon Prison had a lot of our patients down there, because I know at least a half a dozen that if they released them, they'd commit a crime, so they'd, you know, go to prison. They couldn't stand it being outside. This one patient they asked for, he'd been in there for 30 years, and they found out he was voluntary. Oh, thank you. Never had been committed. Yeah. He was signing himself in, you know, when he was a teenager or right after, you know, and never left. There was a lot of them there that way. Each ward had a social system of its own. All eight was chronic schizophrenics, and the guy that worked there that was in charge of the ward, this one patient had a fiddle that he liked to play, but he'd always take it away from him and hide it on him. And when I'd go over there to supply for lunch hour, I'd go up to him and I'd ask him, "Where's your fiddle?" "I don't know, they hid it." And I'll say, "I'll go find it." And I usually put it in the coat room, you know, linen room or something. So I'd go in there and find it and give it to him. And he'd start playing. And he had a repertoire of about 45 minutes to an hour that he had to go through before he quit. I'd find the fiddle about 15 minutes before I had to leave and give it to him, so he'd have a good start by the time I got out the door.
Were they old folk songs, or what kind of songs?
Oh, yeah, they were old, yeah, because the guy had to have been up in the 70s or so. It was chronic schizophrenics, you know, they just sat in a chair against the wall.
Did he get a reaction out of the other patients?
Oh, yeah, they would come around and listen to him. At the hospital, they had a AFL-CIO union ask me, and I was president of that, and they had MESA, Michigan State Employees Association, and that was mostly salaried workers. There was some other. We never did have collective bargaining rights, but we were recognized in the 70s as a union. The recognition. I was president of the union, but I was a supervisor, so I couldn't belong to the union. And this Dennis Shavey, this was probably in the late 70s when they started laying off people, you know. I asked him if he wanted to be president, and he said, "Well, why?" And I said, "Well, super seniority," because the chief steward and the president had super seniority, so he took the Albert. He was the president until they closed. Yeah, well, you know, most of the institutions are gone now. Kalamazoo's one of the few, and Carroll, I think, those are the only two left around. And I know people that worked at Carroll and Lapeer, Kalamazoo, Grand Rapids. A lot of our people went to the VA hospital in Grand Rapids when they closed the place here, or up in the Newberry. There was quite a few went to Newberry, but that's closed. See, the men all worked on the farm, and they used to mow all the grass up there with hand mowers. You know, you'd see these lines of workers going across. They would stagger them and follow each other, and they'd go across, and they had one guy would have one of these, I don't know if you've ever seen one of those one-wheeled mowers for trimming along the sidewalk. He would do that, and all they got was coffee and tobacco and papers for doing it. They didn't get paid for it, but they'd have breaks, you know, and give them coffee and water and furnish their tobacco.
Somebody was not feeling well, how did they encourage them to get out there and work, or did they need to?
Well, if you didn't work, you didn't get ground access. You had to have a job, you know. The patients in the hall, a lot of them worked in the kitchen. See, each floor had a dining room. Now, we had a Korean kid come in there. He was pretty aggressive. He went after a patient out in the chow line, and I grabbed him and threw him down on the floor and told him I saved his life because that patient would killed him. So he shaped up pretty good. A couple of days later, I got the doctor to write an order, and I took him over for Oriental dinner at that Oriental place. So he liked that. And he didn't stay there very long after that. He shaped up pretty quick. But when they had medication, once they get on medication, they'd do pretty good. Because before medication, they were just set and look, you know. A couple of them that were, you know, pretty aggressive. Well, we sent some to Muskegon prison. We couldn't handle them at all. But see, on Hall 6, we had, I think, 8 or 10 seclusion rooms. We had this one patient. He had been locked up for a while, and the doctor interviewed him, and he asked the doctor if he could get out of the room. And the doctor said, yeah, we'll let you out. So we took him down and did the regular routine of giving him a shower and putting him in pajamas. Because in the seclusion room, they just wore a gown. He come back out of the shower, and the doctor was in the medicine room. That's where we had our coffee. And he was in there drinking coffee, and the patient went down there, went up to the door, and said, doctor, I want to talk to you. And the doctor got up and walked over the door, and the patient hit him right smack in the head. Drove him right back across there, and doctor says, lock the son of a bitch up. So we put him back, and he was in seclusion so long that his head tilted over to the side. He must have been like about 3 or 4 weeks. But she was in our hospital here because she was in New York in a mental institution. A janitor was on the ward, and she walked by, and he reached over and grabbed her by the ass, and she grabbed his dustpan and beat him to death. They sent her back to Michigan. But I got along with her, you know, real good. She moved to Cadillac. She was living down there and assisted. I'm from Cadillac, and when I went there one day, I run into her on the street, and she was living in assisted living down there in Cadillac. Brian, he's from over on Lake Michigan shore there someplace. He got there admitted, and the doctor sent him home for a visit on the weekend. And first thing he did was get in his car and smash into a school bus. So they had to bring him right back. But I used to bring him out to dinner out to my house. My daughter, he'd go outside and walk around and talk to himself, and my daughter would ask him what he's doing. But she still remembers him doing that, you know.